I love to talk about this topic, so try and stop me.
Welcome to NPD Soundbites from ANPD, the Association for Nursing Professional Development.
This is the NPD Forecast. Your hosts, Jen Bodine and Jillian Russell, are nursing professional development specialists with years of dynamic NPD experience. Jen and Jill round out ANPD's Nursing Professional Development Practice Team and are your personal environmental scanning forecasters. This podcast series features topics that are relevant to the forecasting of future trends for NPD practice and discusses implications that you can apply to your daily practice. Welcome, everyone, to the NPD Forecast. I'm Jillian Russell.
And I'm Jen Bodine. Today, we're going to explore virtual debriefing and tips for success. Joining us, we have Elizabeth Horsley, a true simulation expert. Elizabeth began her healthcare career as an operating room nurse over 30 years ago. She transitioned to nursing education in 2003. In 2005, she was the lead on overseeing a $500,000 development grant from the province of Ontario to develop and implement a clinical simulation program in an undergraduate nursing program. In 2017, she was recruited to the position of Director of Simulation at the Brooklyn Hospital Center. She has transformed a forgotten simulation lab and random pieces of equipment into robust and thriving space in a community hospital. Her role runs the gamut from implementing deliberate practice modules for residents and medical students to incorporating simulation in staff education to enhance the patient experience to developing simulation activities for nursing education. She is currently in her second term as vice chair of the Society for Simulation in Healthcare Hospital-Based Section and is a member of the team reviewing and updating the ANAXL Standards of Best Practice, pre-briefing. She is a self-admitted hoarder of simulation resources, and her passion is helping novices learn best practices for developing and implementing their own simulation programs. Welcome, Elizabeth. I am so excited to have you on this podcast.
Well, thank you. It is such a pleasure and an honor to be here today. I love to talk about this topic, so try and stop me.
Well, I don't think we're going to stop you. I know we're eager to jump in. You know, it's crazy and hard to believe that we are over a year out from the start of the pandemic. A year ago, we were forced into so many unknowns, but yet areas of opportunity for the online environment. And nurse educators and NPD practitioners have had to dig deep and tap into innovative strategies for education as well as for simulation. In December, we had Marie Gilbert on the NPD Forecast to discuss virtual simulation approaches, and she gave us all some great insight to adapt and meet the professional development needs when face-to-face learning environments are just not possible anymore. You can't have simulation without debriefing. So we are excited to dig a little deeper on this topic with you, Elizabeth. And to level set, I'd like to share a definition of debriefing. Defined by Bradley et al., being based on strong narrative pedagogy requiring an engaging and enthusiastic dialogue. Good debriefing is a reflective, engaging, and informative dialogue which helps faculty understand the learner's thinking, helps the learners affirm or correct their thinking, and cultivates anticipation and assimilation. So, Elizabeth, how has virtual simulation changed the way we debrief?
Well, it's definitely changed some elements of the debriefing process. However, I am a firm believer in best practices, regardless of the communication platform. Debriefing is a complex and dynamic skill set, and it's not necessarily innate in most people. It's like anything else. It takes deliberate practice to master that skill. At the end of the day, we want to create a psychologically safe environment, and I will explain this a little further down in our talk today, where we can explore and dialogue performance gaps and the learner's frames, meaning what led them to a course of action or inaction. I also like to add that we also acknowledge exceptional actions. I think too often debriefing can easily become a grocery list of what people did wrong. That's not my style. Let's have some authentic learning conversations that also have something positive about them. Conversely, transferring debriefing to a virtual platform, it's more than just a change of venue. You don't just say, oh, well, I'm not sitting around that table with everyone anymore. I'm sitting at my kitchen table in front of my laptop. No, 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 no. There are certain adaptations that need to be made in order for your debriefing to remain effective. Going back to how this year has changed us, I don't think we've realized just how much of human communication and interaction is rooted in nonverbal activities. Also, virtual debriefing is not just a physical change of platform. It's having to be more explicit, as we can't rely on those nuanced little things like tone and eye contact, head bobbing and shaking, or even those expressions of and what does that mean? Prior to COVID, I taught a number of different simulation education courses. Going to virtual was very difficult for me, because I counted on drawing on the energy of the room. I counted on looking at people's faces, how they were sitting, how I felt like they were responding to me. And when you don't have that, it was almost like losing a third limb. Again, I can't stress enough the characteristics of a good debriefing experience, whether live or virtual. Rely on that atmosphere of psychological safety, respect, and trust and confidentiality among all your participants. And finally, and I like this one, curiosity. One of the greats in the debriefing literature is Jenny Rudolph, and she calls it, you need to be a cognitive detective.
I love everything you just said, and I'm so disappointed that our listeners can't see you right now, because you are literally demonstrating the importance of those body language cues that we get from people. If listeners just imagine, if you can, Elizabeth is using her hands a ton as she is explaining all of this. And it is part of the story and part of the enjoyment of it. So I can see where, when you go to this virtual environment, that can take away a lot of those things we can see and we use for teaching and learning purposes in an in-person environment.
Well, interestingly, I taught another course this year and I was debriefing, and you said I'm using my hands. And at the moment they caught the still shot of the group, my hands are in the air like this, and you can't tell whether I'm excited or I'm attacking someone, but that I use them, I can't not use them. So, you know, I didn't realize it, but that's interesting. But those little things that you count on, they're gone. They're difficult. And the hands you can still see, but facial expression or looking at you, that's different. It's gone.
Elizabeth, I think this topic of conversation is a great segue to our next series of questions, really focused on some best practices identified from Chang et al.'s article published in The Advances in Simulation, A Practical Guide to Virtual Debriefing's Communities of Inquiry Perspective. So this article highlights a unique set of challenges that virtual debriefing poses. The literature has shown that a strong sense of community contributes to effective learning environments. And the Communities of Inquiry, or COI, and not to be confused with conflicts of interest in the accreditation and continuing education world, but the COI, Communities of Inquiry, this is a conceptual framework that was originally developed for asynchronous text-based online learning. This provides a structure to approach virtual debriefings. So there are three core elements that contribute to the learning experience during a debrief. One is social presence, the second is teaching presence, and the third is cognitive presence. There is a great Venn diagram visual in Chang's article to depict this framework, so I highly encourage you listeners to check this out. And we'll be sure to reference where and how you can locate these resources at the end of our episode today. So first, we'd like to take a closer look at social presence. Chang et al. Defines social presence as when the learners and educators feel socially present or real during their online interactions. Collaborative contribution is key to support effective reflection, analysis, and synthesis of learning. There are three components that ultimately contribute to social presence, and they are all enabled by psychological safety. So first being open communication, two, emotional expressions, and three, group cohesion. Elizabeth, can you tell us more about social presence and the barriers to establishing social presence in a virtual setting?
Okay. Well, first off, and full disclosure, I'm a huge fan of Adam Chang, and not just because he's a fellow Canadian. I've read nearly everything he's written. I've been to numerous conferences he's presented at, and I've been to workshops that he's facilitated. Last fall, I actually took the Master Debriefer course through the Debriefing Academy, which he co-founded, and he co-led the course. If you're looking for some really good literature in debriefing, definitely check out Adam Chang's work and some of the work of his team. This paper is an excellent read, and it's actually, again, personally, an interprofessional collaboration between some great sim minds like Adam Chang and Walter Epic, and also Sharon Griswold and Robbie Hales, who were, by the way, instructors in my master's program. So I love this paper for a lot of reasons. So the social presence, I believe I already briefly touched on the concept of psychological safety. Psychological safety is one of the pillars within simulation, regardless of the modality you're using. And psychological safety refers to the sense that learners have when they are indeed in a safe learning space. They feel like they can take some risks without fear of reprisal and consequences. And learners need to have this in order to openly communicate and participate. And think about it. Society rewards us for not making mistakes. In debriefing, it's kind of the opposite. We want them to make the mistakes so we can get together, discuss, and learn from them. What led you to that course of action? Again, going back to that whole idea of being the cognitive detective. And sometimes learners, they just didn't know. Just a cognitive piece of information that they just didn't have. But more often than not, there's a rationale based in some prior experiences contributing to their action or inaction. On the note of the psychological safety, there is a fantastic paper, again, by Jenny Rudolph, her colleagues at the Center for Medical Simulation at Harvard, which is, they are gurus in the simulation world. And it's called Establishing a Safe Container for Learning. I believe every single person working in simulation needs to read this paper. So you've got that psychological safety. Now, normally, your sense of psychological safety is created in a time known as the pre-brief. So your learners come, the objectives of the scenario are laid out, expectation, your rules of engagement, even maybe things like where equipment is, how does the defibrillator in this case work? If you want to get the mannequin, the simulated patient's blood pressure, how do you do it? All those little details. Well, now the onus is on you to create this in a virtual space. And the literature is very clear. The higher the level of engagement on the part of the learners, there will be a deeper and more meaningful learning. And ultimately, this will translate to the patient care setting. So I realize I've gone off on a little tangent here, as I am often wont to do, on psychological safety. But that comes into this social presence. It's wrapped up with this concept of psychological safety. Some of the barriers to creating this sense of social presence is what I said at the beginning, the computer interfering with our eye contact. our body language, even things around directionality of gaze, how long you hold someone's gaze. It may be difficult to identify an upset learner or a confused learner. Depending on the location of some of your participants, some people may be doing this from the comfort of their home. Other learners may be sitting in some place that's open and public, people walking by. That can be very distracting. Think about how many times you've been on a call, a Zoom meeting, what have you, and there's a dog barking. Not that I have any issues with dogs, but maybe while you're debriefing, a dog barking, a baby crying. I'm here in New York. I'm sure a few times people have heard the sirens and the city sounds going by while I've been doing something. So you've got that. Learners might not feel like they really are physically in a confidential space. And again, this was pointed out to me in the course. We didn't realize how much we learn in human communication from simply going, And I guess nobody can see me, Jen and Jillian. I'm bobbing and nodding my head right now, but how much we take from that. So some strategies to get this social presence, as I alluded to earlier, that sense of pre-briefing, letting the learners know what's going to happen. Again, setting up those rules of engagement. One of the big concepts in simulation, whether virtual, whether in real life, is called establishing the fiction contract, meaning you engage with your learners in an agreement. We're going to treat this as a real patient and proceed as such. We know this is simulated, but for the best learning for everyone together, we treat this as if it's real. Also, there's something called, and this was developed again, by the Center for Medical Simulation at Harvard, called the basic assumption. Basically stating that everyone's here smart and you all care and you want to learn and you want to do your best. So you can set that up with your learners, that fiction contract, letting them know we're in this together, to learn together, to do our best. Discussing and clarifying the expectation, what's going to happen in this activity. Instead of just bringing all your learners on and saying, well, we're going to talk about diabetic ketoacidosis. What are the expectations? How is this going to roll out? Where do they get their information? What are they going to see? What are the objectives for this? Again, that's a whole nother topic for another presentation, how many objectives you give away at the beginning of a simulation, but we'll save that talk for another day. So clarifying those expectations, the logistics. Also, is this session being recorded? If it's being recorded, what happens with that recording? Who has access to it? How long is it kept for? You also want to be warm and attentive yourself. Also, really important for facilitators to show that vulnerability. And, you know, again, tangent time. I learned the importance of this week. I was working with some of our new higher RNs in the hospital. I'm doing some sessions around empathetic communication. So I told them, shared with them a little story about, well, my second week on my first job in the operating room. So any of the OR nurses out there from about 30 years ago might get the significance of this. When I missed seeing a sterile indicator that did not turn sterile before opening a tray for a case, we went ahead with the case. So I shared with them that experience of me just about, well, pretty much got well into a meltdown in the nurse's station my second week on the job. But you know what? One of those nurses said, I really appreciated you telling us this. So showing that vulnerability, I don't know why healthcare professionals have a very short memory of their learning curve for things. We always feel like everyone who's experienced, they just know everything. They were all born knowing how to titrate dopamine. Never has been an issue, but they weren't. So sharing that vulnerability with them, validating and normalizing how your learners are feeling, what they're saying in the debriefing, paraphrasing and recapping your basic communication strategy. You know what? Something also very simple I read, making sure everyone's name and or how they want to be called or addressed is showing up on their little box on the screen. Orienting the learners to the environment, just like any other environment would be in. Respectful communication. Also this too, sarcasm and humor, and you may be very good at it, doesn't necessarily translate virtually when people don't have your facial expressions or body language or whatever was going along with your little story. Some really good phrases to keep in mind that you can use: I want to hear your thoughts. Let's talk about. I was really curious. What might have happened if? And this is another one. And a good rule of thumb with debriefing, whether virtual, whether in real life, if you think you're talking too much, you probably are. So zip it.
Wonderful pearls of wisdom there. And a couple of things actually stuck. Well, a lot of what you said stuck out to me, because I appreciate the vulnerability piece of this, especially. And I present frequently about leadership, preceptorship, and I talk about all of the things I've ever done wrong as an MPD practitioner. I just air out my laundry. And I am often thanked for that, because I think it makes people feel a little better about the things that they've done, a little less defensive, and a little more willing to share their stories when they're sitting there like, oh, well, the person who's come to actually speak to us about this has also committed these horrible errors in life. And I think it helps to create that safe space. And then the humor and sarcasm. COVID has not been kind to me in this, because that is probably my number one thing. I was actually looking at Jill's face when you said that, to be like, oh yeah, Jen's in trouble here. And it has definitely not translated well for me, because I'm a very sarcastic person and I wear a lot of facial expressions for things. And I think a lot of things may fall short here in the Zoom arena where people can't really see what I'm doing. But you've made some very, very great points. And as an educator, I think it is important to be vulnerable, which is going to lead me to our second part of this conversation, which is the second element of the COI framework, which is educator presence. So we know that educators design and implement educational activities. This type of presence helps to facilitate understanding and clarify misconceptions. So every educator should have a good grasp on the educational design model, adult learning principles, and effective teaching strategies. But can you tell us a little bit more about the educator presence in the virtual environment and the barriers to establishing this presence and strategies to enhance this presence?
With debriefing, always, 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 whether it's virtual or in person, you need to use a structured debriefing framework. If you don't have a framework, it's just a conversation. Now, back in the day, I've been in simulation 15 years now. Back in the day, I mean, it was basically plus delta. You see me drawing like a little grid and a plus sign and a change triangle delta sign. And that was it. It just becomes a list of what you did wrong. You did this, you did this, you did this. Or it becomes a lecture. You should have known better. You should have done this. You should have known. Always use a framework. It organizes your thoughts, organizes your structure. You start reading and pick out a framework. There will be sample scripts, sample phrases, and they are incredibly helpful. And there's so many out there. They're not hard to find. There's Pearls, which is the one that Adam Chang co-created, GAS, the Diamond Model. There's one specifically for nursing education, Debriefing for Meaningful Learning. There's so many. That's just scratching the surface. There's all kinds of them, not hard to find at all. But use a structure. Do not just wing it. You don't just walk into a room and say, well, we're going to debrief now. What are we going to? You've got to have this structure to it. So the educator presence, that's the one thing. So having an idea around this. And also with debriefing, again, it's a skill set. It requires the practice and learning. It requires people who are skilled in it. So you're interested, you want to develop more of this skill, start seeking out the educational opportunities, because they're out there. So barriers for the educator presence, well, technology, poor audio, poor video. I can't hear you. It's not coming in. What is the best view? Where are people sitting? Are you looking at people's torso? It took me a while to realize I couldn't sit under a light or in front of the window. I was on a meeting, my windows west facing the sunset Monday night. So during the entire meet, actually kind of was funny, people could watch, you know, and see how the sun was setting with how much of me they could see. All these things around lighting we don't realize. Also, when does it become too much for one person? You're facilitating a group, but you've got 10 learners on here and you're trying to look at all of them. You got people posting in the chat box. You've got everyone wanting to share a screen. When is it too much? You may actually need a co-debriefer or somebody to come in and take that load, or just somebody who monitors the chat. You hear that a lot. After you're on mute, I think monitor the chat might be the second most used phrase of this past year. Here's another one. Time zones. It may not help some of you, but if you're doing a course, you're doing something nationally, internationally, or just a small little thing, but I've been caught with time zones this year, not realizing my invitation went for one time or another. Are you central? What time is it there? What time could we do this debriefing? When are we going to do this? Might not, you know, but it just might come into it. Again, if you were doing something through your group that was going across the country. And also, think about that whole concept around cognitive load, how much we can reasonably manage in our heads. So between managing the debriefing, the content of it, what the simulation activity was and what we're taking from that that we want to talk about, that content with the technology. So some strategies to mitigate some of this, looking at your view, good lighting, getting on ahead of time and practicing it. Looking into the camera, I know it find it distracting. Or maybe I'm just really self-absorbed, which is probably true. But I find I end up just looking at myself a lot and not everyone else. The sound quality. Do you need headphones? Do you need it? I'm here in an apartment by myself, so it's not too bad. But I know there's a few times I've done things from work and everybody hears the Code Blue announcements overhead. Again, maybe you need to get that a co-facilitator to help you out. Which view works best? The grid views, the gallery views, the different platforms that you're using. Those of us of a certain age understand the reference to like the Brady Bunch type screen. What happens if there's an issue? Do you have a plan B? Let your learners know. Who can you get a hold of? You know, something goes down, something happens. How can people communicate? They want to get a hold of you. They want to ask a question, something privately, explaining the chat feature and then between what's group chat, what's private chat. So how that those things work. Going back to using a debriefing framework or a script, if you can probably, I haven't Googled it exactly, but I think if you Googled debriefing sample scripts, you probably can get some. I know I have files of them I've found, and it's okay to use them. You don't have to go into this alone. You can get one, write your you have your learning objectives, write your questions down. And like everything, most other things in life, pilot and practice this so that you have it. You can troubleshoot if anything happens.
I sense a theme of proactivity, if we can use that word, in all of those strategies to promote the educator presence. And, you know, that's something that we simply cannot take for granted in either a face-to-face and most definitely in an online environment, because there's so much to manage, so much to multitask, so much to engage with, and keeping your finger on the pulse of everyone else's technical difficulties as well and how you can best support them. So I really appreciate those very practical and very relevant best practices to promote educator presence, Elizabeth. I'd like to shift gears a bit towards the third element of the COI framework, and that's cognitive presence. So in Adam Chang's article, it's defined as the learner's ability to construct and confirm meaning through reflective discourse or dialogue, or simply put, how learners think together. As you can imagine, a number of factors contribute to effective and successful cognitive presence. Elizabeth, can you tell us more about cognitive presence and the barriers to establishing cognitive presence in a virtual setting?
This is an interesting element as it combines how the educator manages the technology and the process of debriefing while keeping the concept of cognitive load in mind. So some of the barriers, again, touching back on the educational one, lack of familiarity with the platform, and lack of familiarity and experience with debriefing. If you aren't really an experienced debriefer and all of a sudden you're having to do it virtually, probably a little more difficult than if you were able to do this for the first few times the live group. But cognitive load, and I've touched on that. And this is actually a topic that's really, I always kind of look at the simulation literature and see what the trends are over different years. And right now, well, COVID has superseded a lot, but looking at pre-briefings really come on the forefront. But cognitive load. So how much can learners absorb? How much gets stored in long-term memory? And how much of it's going to get stored to be able to recall? At the best of times, this is a challenging concept for simulation educators. And poor technology just contributes to the extraneous load for our learners. The extraneous load refers to things that don't contribute to the learning at hand. Again, I think this is another topic I could do another entire podcast about cognitive load. But also for the facilitator, it's not just thinking about the learner's cognitive load. So how much is involved in this scenario? What are our objectives? How much do we want them to do? But your cognitive load as a facilitator, you need to be mindful of it for yourself. You have all the regular tasks of debriefing, recalling and reviewing the events of the scenario, prioritizing topics for discussion, formulating questions, monitoring learner responses. Meanwhile, aligning all of this with the objectives of the scenario, plus maintaining psychological safety, there's a lot going on for the debriefer. Plus, if you're not really techno savvy or you're having to manage all the technology. So whether it's the learners or whether it's the facilitator, when anyone's mental workload exceeds cognitive capacity, something's going to suffer. So what are some strategies? Well, one is learner-centered strategies. And Adam Chang and team, he has a fantastic paper called Learner-Centered Debriefing. Fantastic paper with all kinds of strategies and talking about learner versus instructor-centered. So you can have a look at that. But it refers to things like learners doing some self-assessment, learners prioritizing the topics for discussion, identifying take-home messages at the end. Too often, and I think it's really interesting in the paper and other papers I read, everybody wants to say they're learner-centered. Of course I'm learner-centered. We're all learner-centered. I always put the learners first. But you know what? In any moment of a little bit of stress, we're going to slide into the comfort zone of being instructor-centered. Now, not to say, again, another topic for another conversation, there's times when maybe instructor-centered might be appropriate. But for the most part, for the learners, you're wanting, I guess what we're wanting to say is so that it's very easy for debriefing to become just another lecture. You want to avoid that. You want your learners engaging. You want to draw it out of them, asking them what's happening. So that's where you want to go. Again, with this, those rules of engagement up front, how this is going to work, how you can communicate if you have an issue. Also using little strategies like breakout rooms. I've been in some instances where people have really effectively used the breakout room and you're kind of sad when you're sent back to the main room. But also make sure, what is the breakout room? Is there a facilitator? Is there an objective for the breakout room? Because to be quite honest, I've been in some other situations where we were sent to a breakout room and nobody knew what was supposed to be going on, or it's two people, three people who don't know each other and don't have a lot of knowledge on the topic and therefore aren't even sure what they should be talking about or discussing. There's also platforms that where you have the ability to use a whiteboard or do some note taking, anything that can promote that engagement of the learners. Also, little things make a difference, is having your learners shut down any extraneous activities or apps, you know, somebody's email going, or have you been on a platform and somebody's sharing a screen, but you're constantly seeing their email notifications come up. And also really important too, the use of the mute button. I wish we had a mute button in life, but anyways, but the use of the mute button. So people, if you're not talking, you know, use that mute button. So those are just some few of the strategies there.
You speak the truth. You speak the truth. So we've talked about the three elements of COI. And now I want to talk a little bit about a way that our members and listeners can participate in some debriefing practice. And that is during the SimWars competition that AMPD is hosting this year. And the SimWars competition kicks off in late April and runs through June. And it's an online educational competition that challenges NPD practitioners to demonstrate their debriefing skills after they've viewed some filmed simulation scenarios. And the first place winner will be announced at Aspire to Inclusivity and will receive a free registration to AMPD's 2022 annual convention in San Antonio, Texas. The reason why I was so excited, other than Elizabeth is an amazing human being, to have her on this podcast is because she's also one of our judges for the SimWars competition. And as one of the judges, she'll be using the DASH tool, which evaluates the strategies and techniques used to conduct debriefings by examining concrete behaviors. It's based on evidence and theory about how people learn and change in experiential contexts. It's designed to allow assessment of debriefings from a variety of disciplines and courses, varying numbers of participants, and a wide range of educational objectives and various physical and time constraints. So, Elizabeth, can you tell us a little bit about how the DASH tool guides you when you're assessing debriefing and give us some best practices for debriefing?
Well, sure. The DASH tool, the Debriefing Assessment for Simulation in Healthcare, and it's a reliable and validated tool, was created from the team, as the aforementioned Center for Medical Simulation at Harvard. It's a great comprehensive resource outlining characteristics for high quality debriefing, and then it's in a rubric form, so you've got different leveled outcomes for it. It evaluates strategies and techniques used to conduct debriefings by examining concrete behaviors, and it's evidence-based. Now, many institutions use it. They're doing annual reviews of their facilitators, how their debriefing skills are. I always say, though, even if you're not at that point of using it, it's a great resource just to look at to see what are the qualifiers for a good quality debriefing. So having a look at it that way, how you set it up, how you're making, are you creating that psychological safety, how you're engaging your learners, how you're listening to them, how you're managing different situations within the debriefing. So it's a great resource. My thing for debriefing, though, and I think it's that respect among people, I really like, and I'll tip my two things around debriefing. It's identifying the performance gap and using what's called frames. And frames are why people did what they did or didn't do what they didn't do, and exploring that. And I'll give my favorite example of frames is from when we did in our hospital, we did a simulation for enhancing communication skills to hopefully improve our patient satisfaction scores. So we were working with our dietary, the people who deliver the food trays, and we couldn't get them to speak to patients. So we did some simulation how we'd like to see them communicate with patients. And finally, in the debriefing, not just saying you need to talk to the patient when you take the tray in the room, what was preventing them from introducing themselves, from speaking with the patient? We finally found out that some of our dietary people had been trained in a giant food conglomerate company where they were told never to speak to patients. Boom, right there. That's their frame. That is what they weren't meaning to do anything wrong. They were doing exactly what they'd been trained to do or not do, however the case may be. So this is with debriefing. You want to explore your learners' frames. You may have staff who used to be nurses aides. You may have people who came out of the military who sometimes their priorities for care are different than civilian priorities for care. I have a story, a colleague who talks about coming out of the Navy and going to do a mass casualty drill. And Jen, you can correct me here, but in the military, the mass casualty, your priority was the walking wounded, get them and get them back out. Yes. Whereas a civilian, and the severely wounded or left, civilian casualty is the opposite. She came out of the military, did a civilian casualty drill, and was focusing on the walking wounded. And in the debriefing, people are, what was that about? What? But that's her frame. It doesn't mean she wasn't doing something right. It doesn't mean she had a knowledge gap. And then that's what debriefing is exploring those frames of what brings people to that course of action. Through those performance gaps. So what you would like to see happen from your learners, what actually happens, and closing that gap, and that's how you can use debriefing. Well, you know, explaining why one choice might be better than another, what happened here. And if I had to bring debriefing down, frames, performance gaps. And then as a side note, if they did something really well, acknowledge it. Just because I don't think we do enough of that in the world. That was really good care. That was excellent, the way you communicated with that patient about their diagnosis. I'm curious, have you had experience doing that? Have you worked in a palliative setting before so that you've done that? What are your experiences? But I just really believe that. Give them some positive too.
Okay, so couple things here. The first thing is we had our podcast, last month's podcast, and we did have a naval aviator on who did a short discussion on debriefing. And he was talking about how in debriefing with aviation, you go first if you're the lead, and you will list everything that you did wrong. And it becomes a challenge to make sure you pick that out before anybody else in the group can. And if somebody else can pick out something you've done wrong, then you haven't reflected enough on your actions. That's my first, how you feel about that. And my second is, he said their debriefings can take up to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So what are your feelings about what the appropriate length of a debrief are? If you could just part A and part B that for me.
Well, generally the rule of thumb is the debriefing's twice as long as the scenario itself. Like whether it's an academic or a hospital or whatever, a general educational setting. So, and that's one of the things people often will do wrong is they'll drag some scenario out for 40 minutes and then find there's only 5 minutes left to debrief. It's the other way around. Put the time into the debriefing. I'm not sure what his objective is. Like, they're naval aviators. So is he talking about the intricacies of landing a fighter jet on an aircraft carrier? Then have at it, go for 6 hours, because I want to make sure they do that right, you know? Also, I want to be careful here that I don't sound like I'm trying to sugarcoat it and not tell learners when they've done things wrong, because I was an OR nurse. By God, if somebody contaminated the sterile field, there's no room for debriefing. You contaminated the sterile field. This is what it is. So I'm in no way advocating, you know, sugarcoating or not telling them. And if things really went down, you know what, let people know or help them learn. I did a great workshop with Adam Chang one time, actually. And what it was is it was a debriefing and two people, and they'd just done a cardiac arrest scenario, but they just bombed totally. So he's like, okay, so how do you approach this? And they're everybody's trying to find your communication skills were good and trying to, if people need directive feedback, you need to put a backboard under a person in order to do compressions, because this is how you hold the bag so that you can, you know, provide bag, mask, valve to the patient. That's okay. In no way am I suggesting that we don't give learners appropriate feedback. But there's that line between just becoming a laundry list of every single thing you did wrong and leaving people feeling really badly. Give them why. If you're giving feed, you need to give them a rationale why. This is how you do this. This is what you do. Let them go again. And again, then this, again, another potential presentation, debriefing and feedback and where that comes in. With feedback, I'm not interested in a discussion of the sterile field contaminated. It's contaminated. End of discussion. This is how we open one. This is how you put your gloves on. This is how you do these things. So, you know, 6 hours, though, again, it's a big plane. It's one of those big things on one of those aircraft carriers. I don't know. Go for it.
I'm really glad that you clarified that one piece, because I was going to ask you, how deep do you dig to find something that went well in a scenario that just did not go well? Like just giving a positive response for positive response sake. Sometimes, you know, the sim goes in the toilet.
You know what, though? I went to another workshop one time. Mm-hmm. And if your simulation really washed out and the learners didn't know, then was it even appropriate for them? Think about that. And I'll give you an example. When I worked in nursing education, second semester nursing students, and we just got in the simulation equipment. This was 15 years ago. And this faculty member just wanted to, you know, do this case. She creates this intense diabetic ketoacidosis case. Those kids couldn't pick an insulin syringe out of a pencil case. Okay. I mean, it was totally inappropriate. They hadn't even covered basic diabetes anywhere yet. They didn't even know what a pancreas was. And you're throwing that at them. So, you know, I always thought that if there's a real washout, then was there a problem? Like this was not appropriate for them at all. Or I'll give you, you know, in our hospital, we're rolling out, we need to do some things around code blue training, but a lot of young staff, a lot of people who just don't have those basics. So we're doing a rolling refresher program of just basic, like, assessing the patient, is this rapid response? Is it code blue? Getting the backboard under them, bagging them, calling for help, bringing the cart in the room, and how do you hook the pad? Basic stuff. Because throwing a mega code at these people at this moment is not going to do anything. So it's, again, a whole nother webinar presentation on your needs assessment and your learning objectives. But if a scenario is washed out, then maybe you didn't assess what that group of learners needed, and you didn't create something appropriate for them.
Sure. And from my tally, I have to invite you back for about 12 more webinars and podcasts. That's because this topic is so vast. There's so many things, you know, dynamics to it. So I'm joking, but I'm not joking, because there are just so many different dynamics.
And I talk a lot. So that just,
but we love to listen to you. So it's okay.
I do. Yeah. And it's so transfer. There's so many elements that are transferable in all the work that we do as NPD practitioners. And so many of these best practices from debriefing alone, I mean, this speaks to the work that we do on a daily basis in NPD. And looking at, you know, I actually have the short form of the DASH tool pulled up right now. And you could use that as a checklist in practice to ensure, all right, am I maintaining an engaging learning environment? Am I provoking engaging discussion? So really, it gives you, as you mentioned earlier, a framework, a very structured approach to implementing not just a debriefing, but an educational activity. I see so much transferability to the work we do in NPD, and how we can learn from these best practices in so many different ways.
In a personal level, I think my sons, they're both young adults now. They're tired of me talking about everybody's frame. Well, your girlfriend broke up with you, but her frame.
That is not what you want to say to your son. He's going through.
I get it. You're going to talk about their frame. But really, you know, where people are coming from, what makes them go in that certain direction or think in that certain way? Or, you know, so just thinking about, I'm coming at this from a simulation debriefing background. You're coming at it from NPD backgrounds. what we're all bringing to it.
So, well, I'm thinking about it, Jill, we're looking at NPD implications here for this outside of just simulation, because that's the problem is right now our frame is debriefing should only be used in simulation. And that's not the case. I'm thinking of all the times when I was an educator in the emergency department, when we had a critical incident, and instead of debriefing, I probably just gave feedback. And I think it would have been important to A, establish some sort of psychological safety, because there's not a whole lot of that I've found when we're discussing stuff like that in an emergency department. And I didn't realize what the importance of that was for my learners before actually learning about debriefing. And I think we don't have that context because we don't get taught that in school. That's not something we're taught. That's something you go as you continue with your professional development when you gear that way. But also just having that structure and meeting people where they are and understanding why they did what they did versus, like you said, that laundry list of, hey, your compressions weren't deep enough. You weren't going fast enough. You weren't like, what was your thought process when you thought this was more important than this? What, tell me a little bit more about what you were thinking in this situation. And I just can't imagine how much better I would have been at my job if I would have had, you know, this structure to help me out, and how much better my learners would have been, you know, if I had known to do this.
Yeah. Oh, thinking back to my early days, I mean, you know, like, you know, just that whole, and I'm not advocating sugarcoating because it's tough, not at all, but there's ways you can teach people, right? Berating them and humiliating them. You can still be firm and establish best practices and all that stuff without, you know, leaving people permanently emotionally scarred. The whole critical incident or debriefing after events in the ED, debriefing after events, actually is a really interesting Center for Medical Simulation at Harvard. It was called Circle Up, and it was a method of staff communication amongst each other, checking in with each other, rehearsing a new process or procedure. This came in light of COVID. And then debriefing at the end of a ship, how that would work. You know, one of the questions, one of them was asked, how can we make this shift 10% better tomorrow? What can we do? You know, so just using it that way, I think a lot of the communication tools we get out of this, you know, can be applicable.
So there's one, I see two directions to apply that type of, I Googled Circle Up as you were talking, yeah. Elizabeth, and seeing the elements that encompasses, the briefing, you have a huddle pre-shift, let's say, yeah. You have peer check-ins throughout the course of your work, and then you have a debriefing or a post-shift huddle. You could even compare that to bedside shift report. So there's so many in the clinical setting. I see a lot of similarities, but as NPD practitioners also facilitating events, you know, how important those touch points are over the course of a learning activity itself. You know, within ANPD, we do this as we're implementing events all the time, and how crucial that is to the success of our team, not just the event itself, but the effectiveness of the team dynamic is, I think, a direct impact of those touch points. And seeing the circle up method, I mean, the visual just makes so much sense. Yep. And how important it is for NPD practitioners to role model this. So we may be teaching this methodology and communication approach to frontline staff, but then are we also using this in our own practice, whether it be in a clinical or an educational setting? There's so many, again, just this all is weaving together for me. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing so many direct applications that we can pull.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so much of what's, and I love that, you know, the whole simulation draws on experiential learning, on adult learning, on communication. So it draws on so many different areas. And then you can, like you said, you can take them out and apply them to other areas.
I love that question, because we've been talking about mental health a lot lately, in the world of healthcare, just because, you know, with all everything that's happened over the last year, clinician burnout and whatnot. I love that question that Circle Up asks, sort that you had mentioned, how can we make this shift 10% better tomorrow? Because that conversation may be what lets me come back to work tomorrow, because you have just said there's a potential for my shift to be 10% better.
You know, how can we make this better tomorrow? What would it look like if this were a little bit better tomorrow? And I think, yeah, like that's,
your hope.
Yeah, that's, yeah. So it's fantastic. I highly recommend. It was a great series. I did a couple different webinars on it. And I actually took some of it and then presented it as a nursing rounds at our hospital, just to hopefully try and get people talking about it. So, you know, it's been a tough year. I mean, it's, you know what, it's always been a tough gig being in nursing, right? Well, it's always been tougher this year, but just opening up so people can talk about these things, why people do things the way they do, and a lot to learn there.
Gosh, Elizabeth, what great conversation and insight you've provided us and our listeners today. I do want to close out with one last question. How do you see future innovations and technologies impacting simulation and debriefing as we move forward into the future?
Interesting question. I think in light of this past year, we're all eager to get back to in person, to sit in a circle around a conference table. Simulation's a fantastic educational strategy, no doubt, for reasons which I need another podcast to fully expound upon. However, nothing will ever replace learning and caring for a real person. But I like to think with simulation, we're preparing health professionals for those encounters. And in the end, it makes it much safer for our patients. Debriefing, whether virtual or in person, is just that subtle art of asking questions to get in a learner's head and see what they're thinking, helping close some gaps, and as I like to do, acknowledge some good performance. On another level, though, and this is totally a little bit different level than where we're going, I think virtual platforms are perhaps allowing us to explore and learn more. This podcast, for example, conferences that you could go into online and check out a lot of different types of presentations, webinars where you don't have to wait and hope you get funding or time off from your employer. You can actually jump in and maybe learn a few things about debriefing instead of having to wait. Hopefully, some of the things I said here today inspires you to go look in the literature, learn a little bit more, reach out to me with any questions, start putting debriefing available resources and looking at it so you can enhance your own debriefing practice. See, virtually for now, but in real life down the road.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining us. And thank you to our new and loyal listeners for taking the time to listen to this episode today. We will be posting several resources and references in ANPD's podcast discussion forum, including a number of articles that were mentioned during today's episode. We also would like to direct you to the podcast that we launched in December featuring Marie Gilbert on the topic of virtual simulation. We will also post information about Dr. KT Waxman's upcoming webinar on the evolution of simulation. Also, resources for the Dash Radar tool. And Elizabeth, your email address will be posted. So that the self-hoarder of resources, you are more than willing to have a number of folks reach out to you. So we'll put your contact information.
I don't mind.
Great. Yeah. Excellent. And then don't forget about the SimWars experience. Although the applications have closed, we look forward to all of our participants who will be participating in the SimWars debriefing experience this year associated with 2021's Aspire to Inclusivity Convention. If you have any listeners, if you have any questions, comments, ideas for other podcast episodes, we would love to hear from you in our podcast discussion forum. You can find today's episode relating to virtual debriefing in that thread. You can access this through the Tools and Resources tab at www.anpd.org. You'll then select the podcast forum and you will see this episode's topic. You can listen to our podcast series by subscribing to NPD Forecast on the ANPD website, on the podcast page, via Spotify, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or iHeartRadio. Thank you so much for joining us.
This NPD Forecast series analyzes information gathered through environmental scanning. Our goal at ANPD is to be your leading resource for NPD practice. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star rating on your preferred podcast platform, as well as a review. And if you feel so inclined, share with your friends and colleagues on social media. Be sure to tag ANPD when you do. Those ratings and reviews help us grow this platform and extend our reach. As NPD practitioners, we know our strength is in our sense of community. So the more you share the NPD Forecast, the more valuable this environmental scanning resource will be. We would love to hear from you and encourage you to post podcast topic recommendations in the podcast discussion forum available on our website.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit our website at anpd.org.